Warming temps and heavy rains can spell trouble for your home. Don't wait for a problem. Get a free foundation inspection from PermaSeal. Stay dry, stay protected. For peace of mind, call 800-421-SEAL or visit permaseal.net.
Is the world on the brink of war? Is our media just hyped up again, as they have been so many times in the past? And what about our leaders on all sides of the political spectrum? Are they up to the job? We're talking to you on the Chicago Way before anything happens with Russia and Ukraine. But there are many tensions, and all the tensions are high. And I thought we needed to talk to someone with expertise. He spent 30 years at the highest levels of the American government and the foreign policy world. He was Deputy Assistant Secretary of State. He was Director for European Affairs and Director of Intelligence Programs at the White House National Security Council, and as a Deputy National Intelligence Officer for Europe at the National Intelligence Council. I can't tell you how many tours of the White House he's done. He's retired. He works for the Alexandrian Group. And he's my little brother, Nick. And I remember Nick, Nicholas S. Cass, we call him Nick, when he was punching beef cattle in my dad's meat cooler when he was a kid. We called him Nick the Hook because he was a southpaw with a left hook and he could really sock. And he went on to DePaul, Georgetown graduate schools, Catholic University, other seminars. And he's here now, here today on the Chicago Way, my little brother. He was here before and he's here again today. Also with us, as always, is Jeff Carlin, executive producer of WGN Radio. And I'm John Cass, husband, father, executive editor, or whatever, at johncassnews.com. And here you are with my little brother, Nick, with the world on the brink, with tensions high. You're on the Chicago Way podcast on WGN Plus.
Look, the Chicago Way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
It's the Chicago Way.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man. There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand. Defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso. In a tower by the river. Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago Way.
So, Jeff Carlin, say hi to my brother again, Nick Cass.
Yeah, hey, Nick, thanks for joining us. Really great to bring you in on the Chicago Way.
Thanks,
I love getting, thanks, love getting your insight.
Appreciate it. Good to be here, guys. Hope you're all doing well.
So, yeah. Nick, tell us, what should we be thinking about at this time with fog and BS in the news and spin? What do you think about it? As a foreign policy analyst with more than 30 years in the business, what do you think?
Well, yeah, thanks, John. Again, thanks, Jeff, for having me on. I think, first of all, let me just say for your readers that or listeners too, that I'm in the private sector, no longer in government. I retired on January 20th, 2021. And I'm now in the private sector, and I work, I live in Bucharest, Romania, and handle international corporate affairs for a company called the Alexandrian Group, which has diverse interests in a variety of different countries in the Balkans and Latin America and increasingly in the United States. So it's really been fun. We moved out there a number of months ago last year. And so being sort of a former government official, you obviously continue to look at things in some respects through the eyes of your previous employee and vocation and career. And it's been really to the debate on this issue in the United States from abroad. And again, as a retired and now private sector employee, I don't have any access to anything other than what I read in the media, the international media, but also in the American media. And when I think about the American media and the story that they're being, they're telling you about events in Europe and elsewhere, whether it's on Ukraine or in other things, it's very concerning to me. I know we talked last time I was on the podcast about how I thought that there were so many people who, if you read the New York Times and Washington Post, you may never know some very, very important facts about some of the areas that are, you know, of significance in the United States. And I know we're Middle East. And so before we get into the Ukraine, I would just add that in Kurdish media right now, people are talking about the arrest of a couple of opposition journalists in northern Syria, which is controlled by America's partner, Kurdish partner in the region, which is dominated by a Marxist-Leninist movement known as the PKK, and its offshoot in Syria. Now, you say to yourself, why is it important that, you know, there's a couple of opposition journalists are arrested in a place like Syria? Well, it's first of all, it's not a couple. As independent journalists privately tell me, it's becoming more and more of a problem every day. But the interesting thing about it for our purposes is that you'll never hear about that in the Western media, because the Western media is so invested in the idea that the Kurdish forces in Syria, YPG, the PYD, whatever the acronym is that they go by, the Syrian Democratic Forces, are on the side of democracy and freedom and promoting Western values. And of course, nothing could be further than the truth. I mean, the reality is much more complex. You won't know that in the West, because the Western media won't cover that. Similarly, when you look at what's happening in Europe generally, Central Europe, Eastern Europe, the issue with respect to Ukraine. Again, you can look at the Western media and the U.S. media, and you can find good articles written by intelligent people who perhaps will give you, you know, a more complete picture. But the general thrust, I'd say, of the message from the CNNs of the world and the MSNBCs, etc., has been that this is the greatest threat to the United States in modern memory, that this is a risk, that there are many people who are advocating the United States be prepared for war in Ukraine. And when you look at it and its complexity, you have to really start to begin to question what it is that you're on the receiving end of. And that's really important, because in the United States, at least in theory, the citizens are supposed to be the ultimate authority in the country, the law and the citizens, right? Citizens vote for their representatives, but they need information in order to make reasonable calculations as to whether or not their representatives, their leaders, their military leaders, and others are making the right decisions. And as a free people, we have the right to be able to make that. And so it's really I think, quite alarming that all too often, these very, very complex issues are being treated as cartoons, and have more of the caricature of manipulation and molding the audience as just another element in pursuit of some other agenda, a class or other agenda, rather than informing them and treating them as if they are supposed to be ultimately, you know, the sovereign people that they are. And so it's really kind of distressing in that respect.
It's Nick, the narrative, right, Nick? I mean, it sounds like what you're describing is you see a different quote unquote narrative, as they would call it in media these days, which is kind of interesting. And I'd love to get your perspective even more on that, on, you know, what is being said locally where you are now, or versus what is, you know, you see on places like CNN. I mean, is it the same message across the planet, or is it very unique to us?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, I think, you know, it's with the point of view of all the diplomacy that's going on, whether it's from countries in Eastern Europe or the United States, okay, you have to understand that much of the messaging is going to be diplomatic messaging. That's going to be reflected in media. And that's a normal function. If you're a diplomat, if you're a practitioner, you try to get your point across and you try to convey that through the various media that exist. That's an important and that's a traditional thing. And it requires a great deal of skill. Okay. Because sometimes diplomacy, you know, requires some nuance. Sometimes you need real clarity and sometimes you need to be ambiguous. Now, the problem is that that was easier for, you know, European states, shall we say, or maybe even America back, you know, before the Cold War. But what we're seeing now is a greater propensity toward blowback. In other words, the things that you say that are pointed toward foreign audiences come back and affect the domestic audience, and there becomes this sort of feedback loop, which ultimately affects perceptions in a way that ought not to be. And I think part of that is a function in part of the globalization of information networks, the media, the think tanks espousing a practitioner's view of the world. And what happens over time is that goes beyond simply espousing a view to a sort of consolidation of a class view, a leadership class view. And that class has its own class interests, and that class is interested in maintaining a status quo, increasing class power. And so it starts to look at information or sources of information or opinions that don't jibe with the class view as threats to dominance. And I think that's becoming much worse in this situation. And again, I think it's at play in a variety of different ways. I mean, you bought this just in your most recent piece on Trudeau. And again, I would just say for anybody who likes to read, you know, great writers, that you know, you're fortunate enough with John Cass News to actually read the best writer in America. It's not just about analysis; it's about the power of the way in which you marshal the argument and your ability, I think unique ability, to sort of bring it home to people at every level. Anybody who reads it will understand. I mean, it's extraordinarily powerful. So I certainly wouldn't be able to improve on that in any way, shape, or form in terms of describing the bottom lines, but there might be potentially some things in which I might be able to sort of enlighten. So,
thanks, go ahead. Bro. Yeah. Thanks, bro. I mean, I love you, man. You know that. Yeah.
But, no, I do. And people can judge. I mean, the great thing is it's online. People can look at it. If they like you or hate you, they can look at the artistry, and they can, if they are honest, they'll know that. So anyway.
So speaking to the point that you made about blowback and clarity, I sent Jeff. Jeff has a sound from Kamala Harris. She was asked simple questions, and it sounded to me that there were issues there that would be read differently by the American audience and Russian and Ukrainian audience, including the policymakers. Jeff, can you play that?
The basis for the Munich Security Conference, and certainly one of the founding reasons for NATO, which is European security. And the connection and alliance between Europe and the United States. This was a productive trip in terms of the extensive bilateral meetings that we had that were in furtherance of the ongoing collaboration and partnership with our allies. It was important in that, as you all know, this is a moment that is very dynamic, if not every hour, certainly every day. There seem to be new moments of interest and also of intelligence. And so we have affirmed, however, all of that being said, through these last couple of days, that this alliance is strong, probably stronger than it was before, and that this alliance has purpose and meaning, founded on shared principles that are very much at play right now. As I mentioned yesterday, if we think about those principles, one of the most important is about a mutual respect for sovereignty and territorial integrity, which at its essence is what is at play in terms of Russia's posture as it relates to Ukraine. At stake is the NATO alliance in terms of our unity, joining together through sometimes compromise, certainly always through collaboration, to be a unified voice, especially when these very founding principles of our relationship are being compromised, if not attacked.
Whoa, I'm having trouble understanding what the heck she's saying, but it sounds like she's talking at cross purposes with herself. We are not, I'm glad to say that I don't, that's in this discussion of ours, we don't have some moron from MSNBC just happy to regurgitate her talking points. We have Nicholas Cass, who knows what he's talking about and has seen this again and again. So, Nick, what do you make of that commentary about the at stake is the NATO alliance when they seem to be pushing the NATO alliance to the breaking point?
Well, I mean, I think that's a really good point. There's a couple things. There's a couple issues that come to mind, and I don't mean to be unduly harsh. I really don't. But this is an example of, I think, the limit that she has, the vice president has, in terms of digesting and then explaining the points of view of the United States. I mean, there are a lot of things in there that just I found very, didn't seem to make much sense. I mean, she was talking about NATO as being stronger than ever before, and yet at the same time, that NATO's unity is at stake. And subsequently, in that speech, she talks about, or a question was asked. I mean, sometimes journalists do ask questions, even in this environment. It's they do ask very, very basic questions. And one journalist asked, how can you square, the idea that Putin has already decided to invade with the idea that sanctions are a deterrent, and she was unable to answer. I think it probably would have been better just to say we'll punish him with sanctions, but it leaves again some, you're scratching your head, and she's supposed to be the leader. So, I mean, I think that that's a problem, a separate issue. That's a problem of her personality and the failings that, are well documented. One of the reasons why I think she's very, very unpopular and considered by many of the people, particularly on the right, is not ready for prime time.
But I didn't offer this to
right
to instruct or to sanction the vice president. It just seems to me that this type of unfocused gobbledygook, I've been hearing it since weapons of mass destruction, and we have to invade Iraq and so forth, or line in the sand from Obama on Syria, and all this stuff. And I just think the American people, I don't know, I'm not speaking for them, I'm just speaking for me. They view this now, and they just, it's like Fauci telling you to keep masks on your kids when you know that it's the loss of the expert, I guess, the deflation of the expert testimony.
Well, I mean, I think I would make two observations in this respect. One is that you could see how this is not something, if you don't know your own mind, it's really hard to do that job. So you really, really need skillful people, and particularly if they're going to be the principal spokesman for you. And it doesn't necessarily mean they have to be, sophisticated speakers. They can be very brash and direct. But the main thing is that you have to know your mind, and you have to have a solid grasp of what it is that you're talking about. And if you do that, then you can be an effective deliverer of the message. So that's the issue of that particular person. I think the bigger problem is, in my view, is that, again, we're seeing this portrayal of a situation in Europe which really doesn't comport quite to the reality. And, for example, okay, I'm living out in Bucharest, Romania, and I talk to people from all over the place, and not just in Romania, but also elsewhere, and people who are well-connected to other people as well. And what I hear from all these experts is that there's a great deal of concern about the United States, about the leadership class, about its competence in being able to manage the situation. Part of that comes from the demonstrable, lack of competence that grew out of the particular nature of the Afghanistan pullout. It's not really a question of the pullout of Afghanistan, which is a separate issue. It is not that it's not a question of the U.S. credibility. You know, can the United States, live up to its promises if it backs away from Afghanistan? And what does that mean for us? I think the real problem is that many people are worried that what Afghanistan signaled and what they keep seeing is an elite class, a managerial class, the class of the United States, which is incapable of doing this job anymore. They are really, really concerned about that. So they are willing to try to heap praise on people when they make the right statement and speech. But I think they're very scared that when push comes to shove, if that happens, that this will be mismanaged and botched. I mean, from the perspective of Eastern Europe, okay, in my view, they want, particularly the NATO countries, they want the United States' commitment. They want the United States to help them defend themselves. And some of these guys have not done as much as they ought to have. And as the previous president pointed out, that was a real problem, that people needed to start leveraging their own economies to start providing their fair share. But that said, they are looking for the United States to help defend them. But they also worry that war can lead to a massive dislocation that will be very, very detrimental to the survivability of those governments and to the economies that, in those countries. And so they are worried that in the process of trying to shore up, shall we say, the NATO eastern flank, Romania up north to Poland, Bulgaria, that in doing so, it will be mismanaged and botched. So there's a real concern about that by the sort of elite class in these countries. And I'm not referring specifically to, governmental points or viewpoint. I think that the diplomacy, as far as I can see, has been very, very correct. But I know that those concerns are out there, very, very deep concerns that these people, the people in the United States, the leadership class in the United States is not quite up to snuff. And there indeed are lots of reasons for that. The other concern is, I mean, here we are, we're confronting a potential war in Ukraine. And not only do we have various European countries pursuing different interests. I mean, the Germans cut an energy deal with the Russians that created a lot of concern on the part of other countries. You also have the southeastern flank to be concerned about. I mean, I think we've come through a period since with the rise of the Biden administration where they thought that it would be relatively cost-free to, bang Turkey around. Why is Turkey important? Well, Turkey's the second largest army in NATO, and they're actually quite good. They've always been a key to contain the Soviet Union back in the day. But, that relationship has soured for a variety of reasons, some driven by Turkey, others by our own, I think, foibles, shall we say. But in the last year in particular, I think in the campaign, there were decisions made to beat up on the Turks because it was a cheap and easy way to satisfy domestic constituencies.
Yes.
But now that we are in a crisis situation or potential crisis situation or whatever with Ukraine, we can see the importance of trying of that kind of gratuitous handling of a very, very complicated and difficult ally nonetheless. Is what the cost of that potentially could be. So those kinds of things are seen, I think, by a lot of folks, and they wonder whether or not we can actually handle the job anymore.
You mentioned the bashing of Turkey, which was going on quite vigorously at the time that the political activist / journalist was disappeared, killed, as a result of Saudi Arabian influence or something, and it became a big mess for the United States, for our diplomats.
Yeah.
And the left here took it as a pretext to bash Turkey. And also, to be honest, and to be fair, many Greeks also did this. I know that I was, criticized personally for not bashing Turkey more.
Right.
Although I didn't see what as benefit if, that had as the if, United as States.
If, yeah, as if Turkey bashing is the way to get what you want. I mean, this is. I mean, look, we understand that there, within NATO, there are countries that are greatly at odds. Okay, Greece and Turkey being a couple of those. But there is no substitute for better relations with those two. They have to have better relations in order for them both to survive and be able to thrive in the area. That's a real thorny problem. I think what you were referring to was the Khashoggi killing. Yes. In the Saudi embassy. The Turks were actually among the most critical, probably the strongest voice critical of that. And they put a lot of heat on the United States and others in that respect. But I think the general point that you're making is that Turkey is a land of repression of the media, and all this kind of thing. Turkey has always been an authoritarian country. I mean, it was an authoritarian country back before Erdogan took power. As a matter of fact, it was the previous regime that staged 5 coups d'etat, most recently in 2016, even.
Right.
The Kemalist regime, which you write about occasionally, referring to this sort of nexus of state power, the bureaucracy, the sort of handmade media, etc., that sort of coalesces into a sort of conglomerate that pushes a certain point of view. Turkey has a lot of problems. There's no question about it. They have there are many things that they need to address, and there are some fundamental issues to be addressed there. But the fact of the matter is, from the point of view of the United States, we have to be realistic in our approach. We have to understand how and why we have relationships with certain allies. It doesn't mean that they're going to be easy to manage, but we can see now, in the context of an effort where we are trying to confront or manage a potential challenge to stability that could emanate from Russia, why it is that we need all these allies aboard. So the problem that the administration faces, I think, is that NATO was already a rather fractious group.
Right.
And the danger, I fear, is that Ukraine could be a bridge too far. In the meaning Python movie, it could be that last wafer
Mr. Creosote? Yeah.
Yeah, leads to Mr. NATO Creosote, to sort of explode. I think we need to be really, really careful about that. We can't give any system too much, put too much pressure on any system to swallow what's going on. And the problem that we have with Ukraine, I think, is a problem of many, many years in the making. It's probably not soluble on the terms that we would like it to be ultimately, given the past, developments in the wake of the Cold War. And, we could talk about that at great length. But suffice to say, the main thing right now is to try to avoid this becoming worse than it might otherwise be. And it's going to be a real challenge for us. And I don't know if we can, I'm worried about it. I'm really worried about that,
But why is this, Jeff and Nick, why is this not being discussed? The stresses on NATO, et cetera, the way you put the problem. Why isn't this being discussed in media, Jeff, Nick? why isn't this being talked about in this context? Which, if you applied the same analysis locally, you would talk about crime as a function of, let's say, politics between Tony Preckwinkle and Lori Lightfoot. I mean, why wouldn't this analysis be applied in national media stories?
Well, I mean, we've talked about this 100 times over, that there's the lack of trust there. There's no trust in media for a variety of reasons, and there's no trust in the bureaucracy telling us people. So I think most people just think it's all BS and say, don't make it our problem, especially in this country. And I don't think there's a genuine appetite to be involved like there was one, as you said earlier, the weapons of mass destruction nonsense.
Right.
I think the one of the things that is not being talked about is kind of the idea that you know, the U.S. and Germany and France are, you know, we're not all on the, really the same page to the beginning of this, as it seems. But the displacement thing that Nick, you mentioned, that's what I, where I think you the U.S. is losing so much credibility. I mean, France has been hurting tremendously from this, not to mention places like Greece, and the all these displacements coming from actions of U.S. making in places like Africa and the Middle East. And it's that there's a payment there, it feels like. You know, I don't blame countries for not wanting to let the U.S. be in charge anymore when it comes to these positions. But how do you alter that as a diplomat? I mean, how do you stem that thought process that, well, the U.S. hasn't been putting up a lot of wins lately? How do we get back on top? I mean, as a diplomat, how would you address that?
Well, I mean, I think that we have to think about what we can control and what we can't. And I think the silver lining here is, for those of us who are interested in maintaining U.S. influence in the region and maintaining solidarity within, to the extent we can, within NATO, that the focus should be on drawing the line in defense of the NATO members, and not to push beyond to such an extent that it actually calls into question the ability to preserve and defend the, you know, the treaty members, the ones that whom we have, for however we got here, we have these treaty obligations. So I think that there's a way to do that. I think, you know, President Biden occasionally sort of makes statements of this respect. You know, we're not going to send troops to Russia, they're a nuclear power. You know, we're going to send troops to NATO. The problem is not that message, is not that idea. The problem is going to be in the execution, because there's a whole host of things that could go wrong, particularly in an environment where people on both the left and right are looking for ways to hammer this administration for its ineptitude. Okay, so you have like the neocons who are going to be looking for, you know, any kind of evidence that Biden is, you know, weak, to drum that home, regardless of what, you know, what their own prescriptions would be. There will be many establishment Republicans who will be doing the same, who will, you know, see this as a potential way to leverage, you know, domestic political. And under those circumstances, if you're a politician, as all politicians are, you're trying to think about how you're going to respond to that kind of criticism. And you will be taking public stances publicly that are designed to allay that. And depending on what those things are and what the policy is behind them, you could see how this could become unintentionally a ratcheting up of the situation and leading to some sort of unintended consequences. I mean, this is always, in my mind, the biggest danger. I mean, everybody understands that the Russians have nuclear weapons. Right. Vladimir Putin is a tough guy, and also problematic in a variety of different ways, and that he doesn't buy a lot of what we are selling. I personally would not want to raise my kids in the Soviet and the Russia, right? I want them to be free. Right. So there are lots of problems with Putin, but the fact of the matter is he's out there and he's a reality, and we have to understand what that reality is as we deal with it, and not gratuitously poke at it. But this all, I think, and if you don't forgive me, I'm going on a bit long, but all of this comes against the backdrop of another problem that the West faces, that the United States faces, in particular in a lot of countries in the East, Eastern Europe, where we are pursuing a rather radical social agenda, which reflects in some respects some of the radical social agenda that is being pushed by the EU, but even sort of ups it a little bit more, to the point where even Macron of France, who himself has publicly raised his concerns about pernicious U.S. cultural influence in Europe. This is a real problem for us because, as I say, in Eastern Europe, people want American influence. What do they want? They want to learn from the United States. They want business from the United States. They want people, Americans, to kind of help them with a redesign, shall we say, of their system so that there's more oversight and checks and balances, perhaps, but oversight in particular of the bureaucracy. And, you know, in the olden days in the communist era, the bureaucracies were all powerful, and that mentality, I'll say zihniyet, the Turkish and Kurdish word, or myalo, the Greek word, you know, it's sort of like this mentality is still prevalent in these bureaucracies. And one of the great virtues of our system is that, as abusive as it becomes, we still at least have theoretically mechanisms by which we can rein it in, whether it's an election or it's congressional oversight. Those aren't simply and easy to bring to bear a lot, but those things do exist, where in other countries they don't. We could be very, very influential in this area in doing things like this, in bringing sort of a more entrepreneurial for view, trade, all this kind of stuff, which would be very, very important to solidifying the ties between, you know, in Europe, in particularly East Central Europe, the NATO littoral states with the United States. But one of the big problems is, and you don't hear about this other than in the most pejorative sense, we are increasingly asking them to swallow a whole host of social issues, which are just anathema. You cannot go, for example, to an Orthodox country and start to promote the same sort of values that you might see in Manhattan.
Or San Francisco.
You just can't. It's just not
right.
It's not realistic. It's foolish. You're asking for trouble.
Not only Orthodox right. countries, Vic, but also Muslim nations. You cannot.
Of course.
Look, they saw us fly the rainbow flag in front of the Vatican. I'm not making a value judgment on anyone's sexual life. I'm talking about our diplomacy and our dealings, where we don't want to give up what our true beliefs are, but we have to keep in mind.
If you say that adapting this kind of radical view of human right. nature is part and parcel of the democratic way, then you're going to discredit the very vocation that you espouse. All right. And I've seen this happen before. You know, you cannot define out of legitimacy people who don't share that particular view. And what you do then by doing that is allow extremist elements to profit
yes.
from the fact that you have driven into exile, so to speak, right. All these sort of folks, whomever. And that's a real problem for us. And I'm sees it in Hungary, and of course there's a strong element, increasing element among the conservative movement in the United States, which sees Hungary as a place from where you can learn. I mean, there are a lot of problems that Hungary has with its other Eastern European neighbors, which, you know, again, kind of would fly in the face of this, of the nation, of notion of European solidarity in the face of this.
Right.
But on the point that we're talking about at the moment, there are many people who, for example, will look at Orban and not embrace Orban, but they will have some real respect and appreciation for what he is trying to do. And these people are not extremists. And this idea that we have so trained ourselves into branding people as extremists, those who we don't like, that we don't realize what the effect is going to be. We did that in Iraq for a long time. We're doing it in Canada, or the Canadians are doing it. Trudeau's doing it, as you wrote so eloquently and so powerfully about. And I actually read something today, I think it was in the Washington Post, somebody talking about the notion of freedom as that they're discrediting the very idea of freedom as something that only white supremacists or it was linked to white supremacy.
Yeah.
I mean, you are asking for trouble if you go down that road, and you're not doing yourselves any favors in terms of your outreach and ability to influence things positively for the concrete national interests that you have. What we are interested in ought to be interested in stability. We ought to be interested in trying to help promote a reform process. We should not be interested in going into somebody's home in Moldova, or in Transylvania, or in Diyarbakir, or Hakkari, or Istanbul, or Athens, and saying, this is how you should raise your kids.
Right.
And to the extent that we are associated with that, we do ourselves it. And just to prolong this, and forgive me again, I have a tendency
no, to... No, it's interesting.
But, you know, the Chinese and the Russians are always are active in Europe. They're very active. The Chinese don't have much strings attached. You know, what they want to do is to invest. They don't care what you do, you know,
right.
And they're very, very, it's very, very, you know, effective. So even our great allies, our friends in Europe also have these relationships with China because they are making a realistic appraisal of the situation, which sometimes we don't do. And the final point I would say about this is that if we are indeed concerned about China, then we should be considering what Nixon did when we were concerned about Russia and try to find ways not to promote solidarity between two rival powers. The Russians and the Chinese are not natural buddies, okay? And it's to the extent that Russia and China are making common cause, I think is in part a reflection of the deep failings of our political of managing our interests abroad. And with that, I'll stop there. So sorry about that, guys. Didn't mean to go on so long.
Nick, no, I thank you very much doing this. And yes, I do have other issues that I'm interested in, like what happened to that copper, those two coppers who arrested the niece of the IED boss. And there's other stuff going on, but we're talking about war here and the relationship between the world and the United States and our adversaries. So,
yeah.
Thanks, buddy. Thanks, Nick.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks so much.
No worries.
For
the show.
Yeah, and please come back, okay?
Because absolutely.
People liked you when you did the last one, and people really like you, Nick. And the next time you come back, let's hope there's no war, no big issue, and so we could ask you about all the stupid stuff I did when I was a kid.
Absolutely.
Like the puffer kite issue, you know. The puffer kite and bourbon issue.
I think there's certain right. certain things that'll just remain between the brothers.
Okay. For Nicholas Cass, my little bro, senior analyst throughout the American government, now retired, working for the Alexandrian Group. For Jeff Carlin, WGN executive producer, our co-host. Unfortunately, he's friends with cats, but we still like him. And for me, John Cass, husband, father, chief bottle washer at johncassnews.com. And if you're interested in sponsoring this podcast, don't say I didn't warn you because we're about ready to start picking. If you know somebody, like I'm thinking about a certain meat shop, I'm not going to say what. Anyway, you can email us to john@johncassnews.com and in the subject line, write sponsorship. So Jeff gets paid. Thanks, everybody. Hope to see you again and hope you'll join us again for another edition of the Chicago Way podcast on WGN+.